Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today on the program, we discuss writing the stories of our lives. And we'll talk about the book, One World, Many Stories, Seeking Freedom and Dignity, Experiences of Utah Residents. That was published recently as a community outreach project of the Utah chapter of the Association of Personal Historians. And my guests today include Paulette Stevens, who's editor of the book and member of the Utah Association of Personal Historians, Tom Taylor, also a member of the group, Cheryl Allen, has a story to tell, and Rosina Balibi, a refugee story to tell, all of whom tell their stories in the book. And we'll be talking with Pat Gant, Associate Dean in the USU College of Humanities and Social Sciences, founder of the 4-Minute Memoir Project, with Susan Yikosh, who is in the English faculty at Utah State University, who is taking over that 4-Minute Memoir Project, I understand. And we'll talk with StoryCorps founder David Isay. By the way, events associated with the book are coming up at King's English Bookshop, that's on February 11th, and Weller Bookworks, that's February 18th, both of those in Salt Lake City. Workshops and presentations on life story writing will be taking place throughout the spring. We'll give you details on that as well. We begin with a conversation I had yesterday with David Isay. And as you know, StoryCorps encourages Americans of all backgrounds and beliefs to record, share, and preserve the stories of your lives. Usually, family members or close friends go into that StoryCorps booth and record the often very touching stories, which are, many of them, recorded at the Library of Congress. And you hear those stories each Friday morning on Morning Edition. And I had the chance to have a short conversation with David Isay. He's on a book tour with the latest book. He was in Seattle. Here's that conversation from yesterday. I wonder, David Isay, is telling life stories, is this something that is increasing in popularity in the United States?
Well, I don't know. I think what StoryCorps is, as your listeners know from Morning Edition on Friday morning, we've done 40,000 interviews across the country with about 80,000 people, and it's 40 minutes where you sit with a loved one and talk about what's most important in your life, and then you keep a copy, another goes to the Library of Congress. And I think of it more as a project about listening as opposed to storytelling. It's hard to compare from one era to the next. I mean, if you consider, Facebook kind of sharing stories, but I think what we can all agree on is that having meaningful conversations with one another, focusing on what's really important in life, telling someone how much they mean to you by listening to their story, is important, and we can always do more of it.
This is about connections, isn't it? It occurred to me as I was thinking about this, that StoryCorps is usually a couple of people going into that booth, could be family, could be friends, telling one person's story to the other.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it is. It's about taking time to turn off your computer and your cell phone and tell someone else in your life how much they mean to you by listening to their story. I think one way of looking at StoryCorps, that process of being in the booth, and it is always, almost always with a loved one, probably 99% of the interviews happen between two people who know each other, and, the other 1%, if you come back to a StoryCorps booth by yourself, there's facilitators at the booth who kind of act as, who bear witness to these interviews and run the equipment, and there are always two facilitators at the booth, so if you come by yourself, two people go into the booth, but it's a very meaningful experience for people.
Why is this important? Telling your experiences, having those heard, listening to those experiences.
Well, I think that what happens in a StoryCorps booth, and what happens with terrific projects that you were mentioning, is that the act of sitting down and listening to someone else tells them that their lives matter, and that can be profoundly important for people, obviously. I think we live in a culture where we're surrounded by so much phoniness and so much attention is put on, the very few kind of celebrities and politicians. And we're surrounded by so much nonsense. That act of having an authentic conversation with another human being, with StoryCorps, no one's looking to get rich. No one's looking to get famous. It's just an act of generosity between two people. And that's very powerful. What could be more important than, focusing on what's important in life and telling someone who matters to you that you love them.
Do you think that sincerity, generosity, you think that's why it resonates? This project's been going on, your project, StoryCorps, for quite a while.
Really
seems to resonate.
Yeah, I mean, I think the power of, people always talk about hearing the stories on the radio or reading, a book we put out. and that whether the stories are happy or sad, people cry, you know, and that's what I hear, you know, all day. You know, I cry on the, I had to pull my car over, you know, and oftentimes the stories aren't even sad, but I think it's that, you know, listening to some to someone speaking authentically. And part of the beauty of radio is that, you know, you can't really fake it on the radio. You can tell if someone's being authentic. It's the power of the human voice. And when you're hearing, you know, people living lives to their fullest, when you hear people being honest with each other, you're kind of walking on holy ground. And I think that can be a very emotional experience for people to listen to. It's a powerful experience. I think to experience it, the interview process, and to listen to the interviews or read the interviews, and it's certainly a powerful experience for all of us who are a part of StoryCorps to be, you know, helping to facilitate these conversations.
Seems to be a lot of hunger out there to, you know, to tell our stories and have somebody listen. If you can't get to a StoryCorps booth, how do you go about this?
Well, you're absolutely right about that. You know, one of the interesting things about StoryCorps is when you finish the interview session, you can sign a release or not sign a release. If you sign a release, the interview goes to the Library of Congress. If you don't, you walk away with both copies of the CD, and we're just as happy as can be that you had a great experience. But we found, and I thought because of the very intimate nature of what happens in the booth, that we'd have a compliance rate of, you know, 50, 60, 70%. And in that time, over the 40,000 interviews we've recorded, we've had a compliance rate of over 99.5%, which really speaks to the fact that people do want to leave this record for history, do want to leave it in the Library of Congress. That said, you can definitely do StoryCorps-style interviews by yourself. And if you go to our website, StoryCorps.org, there's all kinds of information about how you can do it. It's very simple. You know, you can get together with five friends, put in $10 a piece, go to a local electronics store and get a very, very good digital recorder for $50 and have this experience. And, you know, the only advice I'd give is that you just want to do it. You know, don't wait, because, you know, one of the great lessons of StoryCorps, which we all know, but it's easy to forget, is just how fleeting life can be, and that we want to take the time now to have those conversations and say the things to people that matter to us that we want to say.
One thing you promote every year is the National Day of Listening. Remind us, is that Thanksgiving or the day after?
That is. It's the day after Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. We ask the whole country to take an hour out to interview a loved one. But, you know, that's just a conceit. You know, we pick that day to encourage people to do this, but it can happen any day of the year.
And finally, there's a new book out, I understand, from StoryCorps.
Yes, we have a book that's just out. I'm on tour right now. It's called All There Is, and out of the 40,000 interviews that we've recorded, these are 40 of the most remarkable stories we've ever come across. And, you know, it's very much in line with what you hear on the radio, although not transcriptions of the radio pieces. You know, what we're really looking for is the, you know, the poetry of the words of these people. And each one of these stories is kind of like a poem that's really extraordinary. And, you know, what's really fun for me right now being on the road is getting the chance to meet the various people in the book. I think we've done this is our third book, and this is the best one we've done, and it's a great kind of way to knock off your Valentine's Day present, and all of the profits from the book go directly back to StoryCorps so we can serve more people across the country with this very important free service.
And more information on that and much else at the website, is it StoryCorps.org?
That's right.
StoryCorps.org. We've been talking with David Isley, founder of StoryCorps. Thanks so much.
Tom, it's great to talk to you. Thank you.
And, of course, you can hear StoryCorps each Friday morning on Morning Edition here on Utah Public Radio. We've had the StoryCorps booth here in Logan, and it's been in Utah a couple times. We'll try to get it back. Important work being done there. We're going to spend the hour talking about a similar topic, writing the stories of our lives. And there's a book that's out recently, One World, Many Stories, Seeking Freedom and Dignity, Experiences of Utah Residents. It was published recently by the Utah Chapter of the Association of Personal Historians. We have the editor of the book, Paulette Stevens, with us in studio. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting us. We're very excited.
We have on the line as well another member of the Utah Chapter of the Association of Personal Historians, Tom Taylor, who has a story in the book. And Tom Taylor, thanks for joining us. We'll try to get him in. Cheryl Allen will be joining us, and Rosina Balibi, both who have stories in the book. And with us also in studio is Pat Gant, Associate Dean in the USU College of Humanities and Social Sciences, and founder of the 4-Minute Memoir. And we've had you on several times. Thanks for coming back. And Susan Nikos, we've heard your story. I think we're going to hear it again on this on the program today, your 4-Minute Memoir. You're with the English department, understand it, and with Pat's duties in the college, I believe you're taking over that project, 4-Minute Memoir project. So welcome to everyone. Let's start with Paulette Stevens. I understand that the genesis of this book came with your observations of the extraordinary events that were happening in the Arab Spring.
That's true. Last spring, when I saw the faces of those people and couldn't understand their language, but they were showing placards in English, they were clearly trying to communicate some things that were of value to them. The placards were freedom, dignity, democracy, things as Americans we take for granted. We have them. And I thought, with our freedom of speech, what are we doing with it? Are we taking a stand? Are we making a difference, saying what is important to the world ourselves? Or are we being kind of lazy? And so I thought, no, I think people just need the invitation, the call for their stories. And so as a group, we worked to give workshops in the summertime, and we called for the stories from the community about their own experiences with seeking freedom and dignity. And we were really... It was a remarkable experience, and the anthology that was collected from that of 58 different stories is very diverse, very insightful, and people have remarked about how candid the stories are about feelings and observations. So we're very pleased with it, and we would like other people to know that they have stories too, and that's what the power of this whole movement is to say that we have something to share, and when someone is listening or we feel like we have something to say that might be heard, now's a good time to think about recording the stories before it's too late.
So the word went out and there were workshops. What was the response like? Did you get a lot of response?
No, actually we didn't. There were people who came and really worked hard, and many of their stories are included. But most people tend to feel like they don't have anything that's very important. They're not special, or they don't have anything earth-shattering. And yet what we found with the stories was that it wasn't about what happened. It was about what it meant that was so precious about having it been recorded. Small events like three eggs in a bowl from a woman, a widow in Russia, and how that was all she had to give, and how touching it was to hear about it. It isn't about the size of the event. It's how we share our humanity by saying what's happened to us and what really happened to us, and not having it watered down or having someone else speak for us, to be able to take the opportunity and use our freedom of speech in an affirmative, encouraging fashion. So people's lives are touched.
Let's bring in, welcome in Cheryl Allen to the program, whose story is in this book. Cheryl Allen, that's a name you'll recognize, a legislator and educator. Cheryl Allen, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
So how did you learn about this this project? How did you get involved?
We have a local newspaper, and I noticed a little announcement in that. It was very small, but I picked up on it. And I have done lots of expository writing in my life, trying to convince people of this or that or explain why I did this or that. But I have not yet started, until this, I had not yet started to write my own life story. And I think that's what Paulette is talking about. And so I just chose a little vignette from my life that, frankly, got me started in 28 wonderful years of politics.
I want to have you tell that. But first of all, to treat the point, I think a lot of us are intimidated. We want to sit down, write the story of our lives. That can seem intimidating. I guess if you just choose one vignette, that can be get you off the block.
Oh, it absolutely can. And going to these workshops, I was astounded at how much editing and critiquing from someone else helped.
Mm-hmm.
It really made a difference, particularly on your first try at this new kind of writing.
You didn't find that intrusive or off-putting. You found it helpful.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I wonder if you could tell the story that you tell in the book. This is how, I think, how you got into the politics in the legislature.
Yes. Would you like me to tell it or just to read an excerpt, which probably would take 2 minutes?
Yeah, just tell it, I think, at this point.
I have been actually asked many times how I got started in politics, and it was because I had a very bright child who wasn't very challenged in school. He, even as a small child, he did a lot of inventions, and he did become a reader. He liked school because recess and playing basketball at recess was so great for him. But I ran across Junior Great Books, which is introducing children to, even at a very young age, on their level, in this case on his level in first, second, and third grade. It was classical literature. And then getting together with other children and discussing it in depth, going into the moral issues of Goldilocks, of Jack and the Beanstalk. And then I tried to get that in the schools and was told no. And so that caused me to run to the Board of Education and worked very hard to enhance and increase programs for the gifted.
So that's just one chapter. Have you since written other things? Put you on the spot here. from your life?
I have a few more, not as much as I should have. That's the wonderful thing about this class. It, you know, by next week, bring something back, and then they'll critique it, and then you go back and fix it. So I think the class is very good. This phone conversation will hopefully cause me to repent again and get more serious again.
Very good. And I'm sure this vignette involved your children. That is a very powerful pull for many of us to write those stories. Paulette Stevens, you write in your preface, you make reference to this, that we tell the decisions we made, the effects that had. We are the product of the generation that came before, and we will influence the generation that comes after. But if we don't put our stories down, our descendants won't know about us,
at least
to the level that they could have.
And often we don't even know ourselves until we try to find the words, which is another tremendously valuable part of the whole process, is that we review what happened. We think about it in different terms. Sometimes we reframe the memory. We forgive ourselves. Sometimes we forgive others. We learn to we work, and in the work we gain wisdom and perspective that we didn't have before we started it. So the experience is valuable for anybody at any age to try to figure out how we can learn from what's happened.
Mm-hmm. Let me bring in Tom Taylor. First of all, the Utah chapter of the Association of Personal Historians, you along with Paulette and several others are a part of this. Tell us a little bit about this organization.
We have one of the best jobs in the world, and that's we get to listen to people's stories and then help them make them really tangible, to help them get them written and be able to share them with others. And there are several of us here in the state. I think now it's up to 15, maybe even 20 members that are, you know, just out helping others tell their stories and share them.
So what do you do then? You have people come to you. I guess some of you have this as a business, I think. People come to you, they want to write their personal history, you help them do that? Is that what you do?
Yes, that's correct. Many of us do this on a part-time basis. My wife and I happen to do this full-time, where we interview people, we may help people that have already written things, have some of that done, and really help put that in a more finished form, that they can share that with others. And the key is, I think you've said before, is just starting with a single story, with a vignette. Doesn't have to be the beginning of your life, but just to share an experience.
And it also doesn't need to be just in writing. It can be done audio-visually, or like StoryCorps does it, in audio. There there is a particular way that an individual might be comfortable doing their story or telling something about themselves. And all of that can be put into a permanent form, which is really an advantage at this time because we have so many choices. So there really is no excuse for us not to do something to put down our stories because there are so many options for us to use.
Tom Taylor, I wonder at this point if you could tell the story that you have in the book, a very touching story about the importance of names and dignity.
Well, yeah, you know, you're actually, I guess, calling from Logan, which is a place dear to my heart. I went to school at the Utah State University, and as I was up there one semester, it was actually in the middle of a winter quarter at the time, February, and I was just walking through the student union building, and I happened to be eating a slice of the fresh hot bread that they sell. I don't know if they still sell that, but it was, I remember, about a quarter slice, and you could smear honey butter on it, and I was just eating a piece of that warm bread, walking to my next class mid-morning. I came upon an individual that I recognized clearly that was in my chemistry class. And I happened to see him, and it just came to my mind. I said, oh, hi, Mohammed. And he was a young man from Nigeria, handsome man. And he stopped just cold in his tracks and just looked at me. And it was so stark that I stopped. And I would just normally pass by and go about my business. But he just stopped and looked at me and even froze for a point that his eyes were burning into mine, and he just said, he didn't say anything, and a tear came to his eye, and I thought, oh, my, what have I done? I was searching through what I could have done to offend this man or to cause him to just take such pause. And then he said to me, you know, he said, that's the first time since I've been in America that someone has looked me in the eye and called me by my name. And I just thought, how could that be the case for someone to be in this country for at least 6 months and to not have someone call him by name and say hello? And so that kind of was a wake-up call to me, is many of us just need to be recognized and called by name and just a simple hello. So
you talk about a favorite professor as well, I believe.
Yeah, you know, and I mentioned him. He was a wonderful man, very short, but he was a anthropology professor at the University of Utah, and I had him for an anthropology class. It was freshman level, it was a basic class. It was a large, an auditorium that had probably 200-plus students. And he had a practice of having a seating chart, and so he wanted us to sit in our same seats for the first 2 or 3 days of class, and so he could look and say, hello, Tom, and ask a question and kind of go through and somehow get to know everyone by name. And then he said, after those first few days, you can sit anywhere. And then he could call any student by name just because he cared and he recognized each of those students and memorized their names, even to the point where I was walking across campus months later, not even in the classroom setting, and he looked at me and said, hello, Tom, how is school this semester? And I just was astounded that someone could, you know, care about that to that level, or to, you know, really care about a name and an individual, of even though there were so many that he had to deal with. Whereas I had other professors who I'd had as few as 6 in a class for a whole semester, and they never learned a single name. But this individual was able to, you know, care to the level and have a keen enough mind to where he could learn everyone's name and call them by name even after and outside the class setting. I thought that was remarkable. Charles Dibble. Remarkable man.
That's Tom Taylor, who is included in this book. Let me bring in Pat Gant at this point. Pat, the 4-minute memoir, remind us what that is. First of all, I'll pull the microphone over to you.
Well, thank you, Tom. I had the experience several years ago of giving a talk in public for some of my colleagues, and I was lucky enough that there were people there from UPR. And they miraculously liked my story and asked me to do a series of other stories that would appear on Access Utah. And I very gratefully accepted. And my stories were to be played between the two segments of Access Utah. So I knew they had to be about 4 minutes long. hence was born the 4-minute memoir, because I tailored my stories to fit that format. I didn't want other people to cut my stuff. If my stuff were going to be cut, I wanted to select those words. I'm very much an advocate, whether it's a 4-minute memoir or a 400-page memoir, of writing as a way of making meaning. And as you've played the different interviews this morning, I've heard the word the words meaning and meaningful recur. I think that's important. I'm reminded of a scene in the Joy Luck Club where we have a daughter who's never felt that her mother understood her, and the mother in the kitchen. And it's a scene of high tension until the mother says to the daughter, "I see you." And I think that that's what we are doing when we are sharing our life stories. We're saying, whether we tell them or we listen to other people's stories, we're saying, "I see you," in a meaningful way.
And I wonder, Pat, students who come to that class, they may think, I suspect, well, what story do I have that I can tell? And I imagine they find readily, with some prompting, that everybody has a story.
Oh, you're very right. And I think that's part of making the class work, is that you're absolutely sure that everyone does have not just a story, but several important stories to tell, things that will make meaning of their lives and their life experiences. People even said to me when I started teaching the course in summer, and I've taught it 3 times now, they said, the students are too young. They don't have stories to tell. They have to wait until they're older and have experienced things. But I think those folk sell our young people short. They have stories. They have profound stories, and many times have experienced things that you and I would be hard put to deal with. Mm-hmm. Ironically, for those who claim that university students haven't lived long enough to tell stories, some of these students have taken them back to their middle school and elementary classrooms and use the 4-minute memoir as a way to get other students to know who they are, a kind of, icebreaker, if you will. So I think the movement is going on and on from children on up through the most senior of our membership.
And we're going to, after break, bring in Susan Yikosh. We're going to hear your 4-minute memoir and then talk about your experiences in the class and how you came to the project. Appreciate Susan Yikosh being here. I want to, before we go to break, bring back in Cheryl Allen. And I wonder what's your motivation? You might stand in for many of us who are maybe a little nervous about doing this. What was your motivation for going to those workshops and telling at least one of your stories?
Wanting to write some of my things down and do it well. And I might add, I took a granddaughter skiing one day and a cloud descended upon us, and it was very hard to see and the snow was very deep. She wrote that up in a little vignette, and it's one of the treasures of my life. It's simply written, but this is a granddaughter leaving me a memory that we shared together, and it's a treasure.
Hmm. And I guess an impetus for you to write down would be to leave some treasures for your grandchildren.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so as you've said, maybe this radio program will be an impetus for you to write down a few more of those stories. So we'll maybe look forward to those. Cheryl Allen, thanks so much. For joining
very
us
well.
Today. We're going to take a brief break. Coming in the second half of the program, we're going to hear a 4-minute memoir from Susan Yikosh. We'll hear from her. We'll hear some more stories By the way, Rosini Balibi will not be able to join us, unfortunately. She called in and told us that. But maybe we could have Paulette tell a little bit from her story. And I'm going to share a couple of the stories that especially stood out for me. One's a cautionary tale. You went to prison. I think Paulette Stevens got a story from a man who became addicted to meth, and now he's trying to warn people about that. There's refugee stories and other hard-hitting stories here, and that's all coming up. First of all, the events, Paulette Stevens. There are a couple of events coming up, right?
Yes. We have two book signings planned. One is at this coming Saturday on February 11th at the King's English Bookstore in Salt Lake City. It begins at 2 o'clock, and we'll have some of our contributing authors. There are 58 of us, and there are a few of us that are going to come. And so anyone who would like to come find out about the book and meet some of those contributing authors, they're welcome to come. The following week, on Saturday, we are going to be at Trolley Square at Weller Bookworks. And at 3 o'clock, we'll have a book signing there as well. And we have some particularly interesting guests coming to that one, one of which is a young man who escaped from the FLDS polygamous culture, and he talks a little bit about his story. So we have some very interesting material in the book, and I think that the rewarding part about having a book signing is just that people can look one another in the eye and realize that these are ordinary people like their neighbors, their friends, their children, and that we all have something very important to share with one another because we learn from one another. That's the tone of our culture for centuries, and storytelling is the essence of how we pass the values from one generation to another.
And there's a website, Utah APH is where to go. I just Googled that and brought up the Utah chapter of the Association of Personal Historians. There's a lot of information. There's some workshops coming up as well. We'll talk about that. More on telling the stories of our lives following a commentary.
What you see is what you get. I took an introductory business class in the early 90s via EdNet, or Education Network. In spite of its name, the class simply introduced me to the far advanced system of WordPerfect. Did I say simply? Simple it was not. I was sitting alone in a small classroom, staring at the frozen picture of our instructor on a screen and listening to his live voice. I had never taken a class like this one. Beside the petrifying isolation, I was facing other hurdles. Having freshly arrived from Europe, both concepts, computer and EdNet, that is, felt like I had landed on the set of my favorite science fiction movie, Star Trek. Instead of a stern look, pointy ears, and a diabolic hairdo, however, our instructor sported a friendly face, spectacles, and a head void of hair, except for playful blonde wisps behind his nice round ears. I liked him friendly. I needed him friendly. I knew nothing about computers. The first thing he taught me and my visible classmates strewn across Utah was the acronym WYSIWYG. What you see is what you get. Luckily, he chuckled as he spelled it out for us because I felt a dirge of doom as I found myself hypnotized by the pulsating green cursor in an otherwise completely black screen. Is that the heartbeat of the Wicked Witch of the West, I wondered? What did that little green flash hide? During the 8 weeks of class, I uncovered much of the hidden code, but remained forever intimidated by the unseen. But sometimes the unseen is your friend. When I was growing up in Hungary during the early 60s, the political turbulence engulfing my country and her loss to a soul-wasting communist regime brought on waves of sympathy and aid from the Western world. Not political aid, mind you, but something helpful nonetheless. The welcome charity took the form of care packages. Citizens of countries who themselves were still recovering from the devastation of World War II filled yellow cardboard boxes with used clothing, toys, and non-perishable food items for us. My family received one such box from Denmark. Opening it was like a second Christmas. Some of the items, however, we didn't even recognize, like a container of hot chocolate mix. What on earth is that? What do you do with it? We had used powdered cocoa, but instant food was still a thing of the far future, like the Internet or Star Trek. Then there were the toys. While they became an instant hit with my sister and me, my mother fawned over the clothes. Each piece was well worn, but many of them served us yet for a long time. A self-taught seamstress, my mother conjured jumpers, skirts, and vests for us girls from men's suits. "No one will know where that fabric came from," she liked to say. And suit fabric seemed indestructible. Many of those miraculously revived pieces, outgrown sweaters and blouses, accompanied me into my high school days. Outgrown, yes. Out of vogue, no. When it came to high fashion, fast food, and rock and roll, we lagged behind the West by a decade. So who cared if that neon-green sweater showed my midriff? I wore it under the mandatory blue school smock that hid many a blemish and only revealed the good parts. When my shrewd outfits reaped yelps of genuine surprise from my schoolmates like, "What a cute sweater," or "Where did you get that blouse?" I simply smiled. Only I knew how far those tops would go. Had I known the phrase then, I may have reminded the admirers that what you see isn't always what you get. This is Susan Nikosh.
And we'll bring in Susan Nikosh at this point in the English department. What was that experience like? You've been a participant in that four-minute memoir class.
Thank you for inviting me, Tom. Yes, I thought I was just going to sit in on Pat's class and listen in and get inspired and write in the secrecy of my desk and office. But Pat is a little more persuasive than that, and she encouraged me to join the group, and I listened and watched the other members of the class to as they were digging deeper into those many stories that Pat has mentioned before. And it was, I'm very cautious about using the word amazing, but it was an amazing, truly amazing experience. What young people, the stories that they are able to tell and able to show that, yes, indeed, they already have a very rich life behind them. And their approach to telling them ran on the scale between funny and poignant. Mm. Wonderful array of experiences and ways of telling them. Mm.
I wonder what your advice would be to people who don't have the advantage of a class or the workshop that produced this book, who still want to tell their stories. I guess one thing we could say is you can do a lot with 4 minutes, for example. But what would your advice be to people who just want to tell their stories?
I really can't I can't claim ownership over this idea, but just write and just tell your story. Many of us write journals, and that would be a good start to dedicate some of the entries that we put down, not just of the day, but some connections that we can draw between things that happened in the past and maybe they are happening today, or maybe it's an item, maybe it's something that we found that morning, maybe it's a piece of clothing, maybe it's a food item. Many of us will be reminded of family dinners by a simple meal, and or the lack of college students remembering that actually there can be more to a dinner than ramen noodles. But there's nothing too small when it comes to remembering, and you never know what triggers a memory. And the important thing is to record it. Mm-hmm. And in this respect, I am learning and realizing that we are facing a young generation who probably has done a lot more writing than many generations before this. Just thinking of texting and going on Facebook, constantly communicating, expressing themselves, telling their stories. Sometimes it's just a sentence, but then sometimes in a blog they go into more depth, and that would be another way of communicating their stories. But I do believe they all have a story to tell.
And then turning it from something that is digital and out there and simply printing it so that it has a tangible form, setting it aside in a pile, and bringing it back later so that it's not lost. Or the photographs as well. People now, it's so easy to take photographs. We have them in the thousands. But if they're labeled JQP311, then you can't find them again. So unless you do something with those photographs, do something with the material that is in its digital form, in any of its forms, and turn it into something tangible, it can be lost in a storm. It can be lost, and you can't retrieve it again. We're not writing letters to one another like we used to. We're not doing things in a way that preserves the history for generations to come. I think about the slides that people took that are still in boxes, and they haven't been turned into pictures. And we no longer have the slide projectors to use. So we do have a changing technological world, and it's important for us to remember to put it into something tangible so that in 50 or 100 years, we will still have something there to show who we are and what we did.
We're talking, if you just joined us, about preserving the stories of our lives, writing the stories of our lives. We talked in the first part of the program with Cheryl Allen, who talked about how education and her children got her into politics and the legislature. We're going to bring back in Tom Taylor, had a very touching story about the power of names, dignity of names. And he's in the book. Have him tell other stories if you'd like. We have with us Pat Gant and Susan Yikos from the 4-Minute Memoir Project. And in studio here is Paulette Stevens, who's editor of the book, One World, Many Stories, Seeking Freedom and Dignity, Personal Experiences of Utah Residents. We'd love to hear your story as well at 1-800-826-1495, if you'd like to participate, 1-800-826-1495. We'll take a brief one-minute break and be back with telling the stories of our lives.
I'm Mackenzie Hamilton, and I'd like to invite you to join me and Tom Williams for Evening News at 5:30, new in 2012. A new view with daily reports from Moab, St. George, Cedar City, Vernal, Salt Lake City, Brigham City, and Cache Valley, with the latest weather and air quality conditions from the Utah Climate Center. New for You News, weekday evenings at 5:30 on Utah Public Radio, your favorite public radio station for expanded Utah news.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Thanks for joining us for Access Utah. We're talking about telling the stories of our lives. We've talked with StoryCorps founder David Isay, and we have with us in studio Paulette Stevens, on the telephone Tom Taylor. They're both with the Utah chapter of the Association of Personal Historians. A new book out from that group, One World, Many Stories, Seeking Freedom and Dignity, Personal Experiences of Utah Residents. A couple of events will be connected with that book. On February 11th, an event at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City. And on February 18th, it's a similar event at Weller Bookworks. And there are several workshops ongoing through the spring. And probably beyond that, I imagine these are regular in nature, and you can find out more about that if you Google Utah APH.
and you get to their website. We have this with us in studio as well, Pat Gant and Susan Nikos from the 4-Minute Memoir Project. We'd love to hear your story at 1-800-826-1495 as well. Let me bring in back in Tom Taylor. Thanks for being with us. I wonder, in this book or in your personal work, is there a story that's especially stood out to you? I imagine some stand out more than others, and you run across, that's one of the great things about your job, run across a lot of stories.
Oh, yes. You know, that's a pleasure, and so many come to mind. And I just want to add now about all the great ideas and concepts that have been shared here this morning, and that there's really never been a better time to share our stories with technology and things available and the like. But I think, as others have shared, is do something that will last, that will be there in the future. That, you know, this is how we know what happened in the Civil War and the Revolutionary War and how our country was formed, and that is through these tangible pieces, of, you know, that we've put the stories together. You know, as far as memorable stories, one that comes to my mind, and it's not an entire story, but it's just a woman came in, and she was, we talked to her, she's in her mid-80s, and, you know, asked about her sharing her stories and how she comes in and she looks great, and say, how do you keep up with, you know, looking great and carrying on the way you do even into this point in your life? And she says, you know, I get up every morning and she says, I get dressed and I put my makeup on and I try to do my hair, she says, because this may be the greatest day of my life. And I think, wow, you know, if we can approach our lives that way into our mid-80s, and we've even done stories for people that are 105 who say, this may be the greatest day of my life, and approach it that way. And of course, we have the stories that are looking back, but those things that inspire us and carry us forward, and the stories that we share, they inspire those around us. Just these that I've heard this morning, and, you know, inspire me to maybe look at the world just a little bit different, a little bit richer. And that's the value of stories, is that we're all connected, and that we all can inspire and help each other to where, you know, this may be the greatest day of my life, and help it maybe make someone's day just a little bit better.
The people who come to you are probably a little bit more motivated than the average person, obviously, because they've come to you and they want to move forward with the story of their life. What are the motivations that you see? Why do people tell you, this is why I came in to get some help with telling the story of my life?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that comes up is the people that come in, and even sometimes their children, is that we're losing stories. That people, you know, pass on and our memories fade, our abilities, our vigor, and yet the richness of the past and the things that can be shared are what really can help us be better in the future. And so we find people that see the richness of whether it's their father or their mother, that they want to remember maybe the richness of their own lives, that think, here's some things that I want to share. Because if we don't have these put in a really tangible forms, those lives, in effect, fade. They disappear. They pass on, and there's not that legacy or those, you know, that value that can be shared with the future generations. And I can't overemphasize the value of that, of the things that we can learn from each other and from the past. And I think it's that means of that we want to be remembered and we want to be understood, but we also want to have those things that we may have struggled with and the values that we have to share those, to help those that we love or care about or that we don't even know that are going to come in the future, to help them maybe deal with the things that are coming their way. Because so many of our experiences are similar.
I was struck by, and we didn't have the pleasure of having on Rosina Balibi, but hers is a refugee story from Africa, from war. And this line struck me. I'll have any of my guests who want to comment on this. She said, nobody has a voice in war except those who create the war and the chaos. And the winners write the history. And so imagine this is a way for her, telling her story, to have a voice. And Pat, you talked about meaning. This is one reason we write or record the stories of our lives, to have meaning.
Absolutely. I think I came into an interest in this type of work a long time ago when I was in grad school and was doing a folklore project on oral narrative. And I began to read interviews with women, primarily with women, some men, but mostly women, taken in an ark across the South in 1938 and 39. And these were people who had not had access to the public record. They had not had a voice in it. They were elevator operators and fry cooks and midwives and all kinds of people. And from that interest in the Federal Writers Project, I became more and more interested in giving a say to the people who are in the margins and who have never had that kind of access that so many of us enjoy. One of my mentors at UNC Chapel Hill, go Heels, was Dan Patterson. He still is, but I'm not there anymore, of course. But he said that there are many geniuses out there, and our job is to go out and find them and to bring their stories to light. And that's still a kind of feeling that I do follow. I would also say I wouldn't want to bring the chocolate, roses, and actual Valentine's themselves markets to a crash. But Valentine's Day is coming up. And if you really want to tell somebody you love them, tell them your story or ask them to tell you theirs.
That's great advice. Oh, let's turn back to Paulette Stevens. You edited the book.
Yes.
You also have one of your stories in the book. I wonder if you could tell us that at this point.
After I graduated from the University of Utah, I went to Cambridge, Massachusetts, and intended to be a teacher of some kind there, and happened to arrive on the day that the whole town was empty. It's because they had gone to Woodstock. All the young people were in Woodstock. And so I had an interesting beginning in Cambridge.
And peace, love, and rock and roll.
Rock and roll. I got a teaching position at Hanscom Air Force Base and was working with social studies and projects for the young people. I knew that the Earth Day was coming up on April 22nd in 1970, and so we did projects all through the spring with the young people cleaning up and going to the recycling. I mean, not recycling. There was no recycling. Going out to the junkyard and seeing what could have been recycled and saved if people had been aware of that idea. And on the day of the Earth Day activities in the Boston Garden, I was coming home with a friend with my arms full of some goods that we had bought at the health food store, and all these thousands of bright young students from Harvard and MIT and all the great schools in Cambridge were coming down Mass Ave. And it was a joyful experience. We were singing and laughing and singing Peter, Paul, and Mary songs, and it was a lot of camaraderie. And then we came up, we were walking down the cobblestone streets, and the traffic sort of, you know, stopped when thousands of us were walking through. We were aiming for Harvard Square, and on the sides of the roads, we started to see these National Guards, guardmen, and they were lining the streets, and we couldn't figure out why. We weren't doing anything wrong. And then we started to see them with dogs behind them. And some of the young people started to, the songs sort of quieted, and people were starting to pull up the cobblestones. And, you know, they were going to start throwing rocks. And the group of people almost fought them back, saying, this wasn't what we intended.
We didn't come here to make trouble. We came here to celebrate the earth and to love one another. And by the time we came about a couple more blocks, then the young men on the sides who were no older than us, and they were the same sort of people that we were wearing gas masks. And we couldn't find the voice to sing anymore. It was tense. And my apartment happened to be in a brownstone on Mass Ave, and so we stopped by my house, dropped off the things, and started looking out the second-story window, and happened to get a phone call. And it was my uncle from Pocatello. And he said, "How are you?" And I said, "We're having a riot." And he said, "Well, that sounds fun." And I said, no, turn on the news. There's a riot at Harvard Square. And outside my window is a car that they just set fire to." And it was a stunning change of tone. Suddenly, we'd been set up. We were just kids doing normal kids thing, although in a big group, and something had happened that had really gone wrong. A little later, we got our courage up and decided we better go see this. Something historic was happening, and we went to Harvard Square, and there are five streets in Harvard Square, and they had blocked off all four of the other exits. So there was no place for all these thousands of people to go. And so people were running, and they were chasing people with the dogs, and we took shelter behind some stores, and one of the young men in the group that happened to be there started picking up those rocks again, those cobblestones, and aiming them right at the shop windows. And again, the young people wrestled them down. This was not the intention. We have no intention to make trouble. Well, the experience was really a turning point for me. I started to see that there was an agenda behind a lot of things that were happening, and that the media took pictures of things, but we didn't really know what had happened. And it changed my perspective on the importance that I placed in authority. I was careful with it after that. I was trying to make sure that that what was really the true intention of people I understood, and not just what people wanted me to think. So it was an important time for my life, but it also sort of motivated my interest in the rest of the story, because I saw myself being an innocent participant in something that could have turned wrong, and it happened not to, but it was an important learning experience for me. And because it was a piece of history, I feel like I could write about it and say, well, this was my take on what happened during those times. And what happened to me as a result has made me careful and very attentive to the people who don't have a voice. Because just like you had said, Pat, everyone deserves to be heard, and not just the winners. And that's one of the reasons why this book is important to me, because it isn't just the winners whose stories are written here. And that becomes history when we see it in its written form. And therefore, we have a piece in the mosaic of that history.
Very good. We are just about out of time. I just want to tell people that you can go to the website. That's Utah, APH. Get more information. The book is out and available. One World, Many Stories, Seeking Freedom and Dignity, Personal Experiences of Utah Residents. It's compiled by the Utah Chapter of the Association of Personal Historians. We've had a couple of members of that group on with us in studio. Paulette Stevens, thanks so much for coming in. Let's see, utahaph.blogspot.com is the full name. Or you can just Google up Utah APH is how I got there. A lot of workshops coming up. Paulette Stevens, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And Tom Taylor, thanks for joining us on the line.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you very much.
And with us in studio have been Pat Gant. Thanks. And Susan Nikos.
Yes. One parting shot.
Yes.
Get your stories down. Write them, regardless of the format. Don't worry about making them slick and pretty and elegant. You can do that later, but get them down.
That's good advice. And Susan Yikos, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
I understand coming up in the summer, a four-minute memoir program for the Summer Citizens.
Summer Citizens, it's going to be a two-week class because we realize that 1 week is just not enough.
And hopefully we'll hear those on UPR.
Oh, I hope so.
Very good. Thanks for joining us today. Tomorrow, Education at the Legislature. That's the program begins at 9 tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
This is KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.
Stay with us for news from NPR coming up at the top of the hour, followed by Living on Earth and Performance Today at 11. The time now is 10 o'clock.